Presentation 30, Arkansas Camp 1982, time 4:15 on Thursday afternoon. Back to Revelation chapter 9. Now move on into a closer consideration now of the events which are foretold under the outpouring of the plague called the sixth trumpet, which is the second woe. We've been learning so far, of course, that the four angels, which are bound the great of the Euphrates, are the angels which hold back the four winds of strife in that area. I'd like to read you the contrasting interpretation given by Uriah Smith, so you can take your pick as to which one of these two you want to believe. What's that? The Bible. You have to believe the interpretation of the Bible. That's the point, of course, in this particular case. Page 506. The four angels are the four principal sultanates of which the Ottoman Empire was composed, located in the country watered by the Euphrates. These sultanates were situated at Aleppo, Iconium, Damascus, and Baghdad. Previously they had been restrained, but God commanded that, and they were loosed. Well, I can't accept that interpretation at all. It's purely geographical and is completely out of key with the other applications of the great of the Euphrates and other parts of the Word of God. Perhaps I should mention, of course, that there is another river Euphrates that is not Babylon's supporter, and this is back in the book of Genesis. And we need to spend a moment or two clarifying our minds on this point so we don't get confusion from this area. Genesis is the second chapter, and we begin with verse 10, which says, "And a river went out of Eden to water the garden, and from thence it was parted and became into four heads. The name of the first was Pison, that is that which compasseth the whole land of Havilah, where there is gold, and the gold of that land is good, there is bdellium and the onyx stone. And the name of the second river is Gihon, the same is it that compasseth the whole land of Ethiopia. The name of the third river is Hiddekel, that is it which goeth toward the east of Assyria, and the fourth river is Euphrates." Now these four rivers, of course, made up the river of life in the Garden of Eden, and no doubt the Tree of Life grew on the banks of these rivers in their appropriate places back then. And certainly, of course, that river in the Garden of Eden had no connection with Babylon whatsoever, none at all. Now, how then do we find this transition or this use of the word Euphrates as a support to the great city of Babylon in Daniel and also again in Revelation? The answer is quite simple. When men were first created, when God calls churches into existence, he gives to them his own personal living power, and the only power that a church should ever be concerned with is the power of God. That's the only power. When the time comes that this power is lost, as it was to the early Adventist folk back in the late 1840s and 1850s, when Sister Y was led to say, "I saw that the Spirit of God is dying away from the church," then the church ought to say to herself, under no circumstances will we make up our lack of power by any alternative source of power, such as, of course, the power of men, the power of money, the power of human planning and such like. But this is not the case, because as we perfectly well know, when churches lose the power of God, they do not hasten to repent and go back and find that power again. What do? They then resort to other sources of power, which initially, of course, are the powers of human plan-making, human problem-solving, human numbers, and money. Now, as time goes by and the church walks farther and farther and farther away from God, the time comes when the accent is very heavily placed on numbers being increased and money being increased. I don't know how closely any of you folk have been associated with Adventist evangelistic campaigns. I certainly have back in the earlier days before I joined this movement. And in Adventist workers' meetings, the conference president, or the union president, or the division president, the general conference president, emphasized the fact that each evangelist must come up with so many baptisms this year, and there must be a certain increase in tithe income, or else the evangelist position is very much under question. So what is the accent? Money, power, and numbers power. Right. Now, for instance, when we go back to 1844, we find that Babylon fell. Now, Babylon never falls unless there's a drawing up of the river Euphrates. Okay? So think about this. We go back to 1844, and at that point in time, Babylon fell. And that was the fallen Protestant churches who fell down and joined the papal system already fallen. Now, in the coming future, we learn that Babylon the Great is going to fall. Babylon will fall in the future. I can't put a date there, of course, because it's very much in the future. Now, we'll go right back to Nebuchadnezzar, though. I just put the word Daniel here. Now, when in Daniel's day Babylon fell, the great river Euphrates dried up, did it not? When in the future Babylon shall fall, what will dry up? Great river Euphrates. So back in 1844, when Babylon fell, what must have dried up? Tell me how. You said it, didn't you? Now tell me how. All right then, go back to Daniel's day, and what kind of fall was it? It was physical, was it not? And when we come down to this final fall, what will it again be? Physical. But back in 1844, what was it? Spiritual. That was a spiritual fall. It was the loss of divine power and support, was it not? Not the loss of physical power and support. So therefore, if in 1844 it was the loss of spiritual power, then what river dried up? The river of life, which was found originally back where? In the Garden of Eden. That river dried up. And now, in the meantime, having lost that power, to what do the Protestant churches look for their power today, and to what shall I look for their power in the near future? Money power, and numbers power, and state power. And so that is the counterfeit or alternative river Euphrates, which will then be the source of life and support for the great churches of Babylon. So we keep these two rivers in mind, the divine river of life, which we lose when we suffer a spiritual fall, and the earthly river of support, which we lose when we finally come to our physical fall and rise again no more. Good, now back to Revelation 9 to continue our study of this fact, and I'll be kind to you, folks, and move fairly swiftly to the history part of this. Verse 14, saying to the sixth angel, which had the trumpet, loose the four angels which are bound the great river Euphrates. And the four angels were loosed, which were prepared for an hour and a day and a month and a year for the slave the third part of men. Now, quick calculation, of course, tells you that the hour and a day and a month and a year was 391 years and 15 days, working on standard prophetic calculation. We saw how that the previous bit of 150 years ended in 1499 and began on what particular date? It was 1299, but the actual month of the year was 27, July 27, 1299. We're looking for 15 days and 391 years beyond that closing point, which was July 27, 1499, and that brings us to August 11, 1840. And once again, I'm going to let you read up the history, and which is very well written up in this book, Daniel the Last, by Uriah Smith. The basis were planned that exactly on that day, August 11, 1840, the Ottoman Empire came to its end when it surrendered its power to the four great powers of Europe, which intervened at that point to prevent a further continuation of a war between the Pasha of Egypt and the King of Turkey, or the Sultan of Turkey, I should more correctly say. Let's come back now to Great Controversy, page 333 and 334. Actually, if I come back a little bit, yes, page 333, just the way it talks about the falling of the stars, which was, in fact, a remarkable fulfillment of prophecy. And that's described on page 333 and 334. And on page 334, Sister White then says, thus was displayed the last of those signs of his coming, concerning which Jesus bade his disciples, when you shall see all these things, know that it is near, even at the doors. After these signs, John beheld as the great event next impending, the heavens departing as a scroll, while the earth quaked, mountains and islands are moved out of their places, and the wicked and terror sought to flee from the presence of the Son of Man. So, the very last of the signs which tell us today that Jesus Christ is very near, even at the doors, was the falling of the stars. After this, of course, will come the powers of heaven being shaken, which will herald the actual coming of Jesus Christ himself at that point of time. Now, in that context, in other words, in the context where Sister White was shown that the falling of the stars was a remarkable fulfillment of prophecy, which it really was, she then says, in the year 1840, another remarkable fulfillment of prophecy excited widespread interest. 2 years before, Josiah Litch, one of the leading ministers preaching the Second Advent, published an exposition of Revelation 9, predicting the fall of the Ottoman Empire. According to his calculations, this power was to be overthrown in AD 1840, sometime in the month of August. And only a few days previous to its accomplishment, he wrote, allowing the first period, 150 years, to have been exactly fulfilled before Dear Kosais ascended the throne by permission of the Turks, and the 391 years, 15 days, commenced at the close of that first period, it will end on the 11th of August, 1840, when the Ottoman power in Constantinople may be expected to be broken, and this, I believe, will be found to be the case. Now, Sister White says, at the very time specified, on the exact day, in other words, Turkey, through her ambassadors, accepted the protection of the Allied powers of Europe, and thus placed herself under the control of Christian nations. The event exactly fulfilled the prediction, and Sister White says, it was another remarkable fulfillment of prophecy. Is this not an anchor and a sure place? Doesn't this completely establish the fact that in 1840 the sixth trumpet came to its end, right? As I said yesterday, of course, believe these prophets. You may wonder why I'm being quite so emphatic about this. It is because there is a teaching which one person who declares himself to be in the movement is writing a book about at the present time, which will come into circulation probably next year or the year after, don't know for sure when. And this particular person has built up a very, very extensive argument. He claims that there was no event back in 1840. He claims that the sixth trumpet ended in 1928, I think it's 28 or 25, or 20, I'm pretty sure it's 28. And the seventh trumpet began about that point of time. And when we approached him and said, well, what are you going to do about the plain declarations and the spirit of prophecy? He says, well, all Sister White was doing there was commenting on the currently held belief of the time. I don't see that. What I see Sister White saying is, first of all, the falling of the stars, a remarkable fulfillment of prophecy, and then the fall of the Ottoman Empire, another remarkable fulfillment of prophecy. And the event exactly fulfilled the prediction. Which prediction? Josiah Litch's? No. The prediction found in Revelation chapter 9. Now, I have very little sympathy with philosophies which rationalize the clear, plain words of the spirit of prophecy. When we have a plain declaration like this, where Sister White says the event exactly fulfilled the prediction, it was another remarkable fulfillment of prophecy, it gave confidence in the sound methods of interpretation used by Melanie's associates, and as far as I'm concerned, that absolutely settles the matter. And irrespective of how clever or convincing arguments may be which are developed against such a position, I don't find myself being able to support them, even if I can't answer them. That's not important. The plain word of God says it, and therefore I believe it. So without question then, according to the plain words of the spirit of prophecy, the sixth trumpet came to its end in August 11, 1814, exactly as prophesied in the declaration. And it's most impressive, of course, that Josiah Litch was able to prophesy, or to predict, I should better say, a number of days before the event should take place, that on that particular day the event would take place. And of course, you know how it goes with politics. Sometimes a thing can happen quickly, but more likely it takes a long time to happen. And so Litch could have been out by weeks and months, but he wasn't. He had it right to the exact day before it even took place, which helps to confirm the accuracy of the interpretation which he gave back at that point of time. Let's come down now to verse 21. I'm going to give you folks rest from all this heavy history. And in verse 21, it now talks about the aftermath of this persecution and destruction, which I should say verse 20 and 21, it demonstrates that despite these fearful judgments, Babylon did not come to her knees and repent of her great sins and iniquities. And the rest of the men, which were not killed by those plagues, yet repented not of the works of their hands, that they should not worship devils and idols of gold and silver, and brass and stone and of wood, which neither can see nor hear nor walk. Neither repented they of their murders, nor of their sorceries, nor of their fornication, nor of their theft. Now these judgments, those that fell upon pagan Rome, those which fell upon papal Rome, and those which in turn fall upon Babylon the Great, do not affect in them a change of heart. In fact, all it did was to generate in them a fiercer and more passionate hatred of those who were persecuting them. If you come to a person whom is the presence of the old carnal mind, and persecute that person with the idea of changing him over to your ways, he might submit outwardly in order to save his skin. But what about his heart? It's just as black, just as hateful, just as revengeful as it ever was, and his experience, of course, he is no more Christian than it was previously. And so we must never, ever develop the idea that the Roman system was chastened or repentant because of the fearful judgment which were levelled against them by these enemies of theirs, the King of the South, the Turkish, the Saracens, the Islamics, and so forth, which scourged and persecuted that power so terribly. Now, let's just remind ourselves of a story. I've lost my map here, but the Turks, they laugh at my map. It was not a bad map after all, really. Now, the Turks invaded all of North Africa and swept up into Spain. That's across the southern route. And on the northern route, they penetrated as far as Vienna in Austria, which certainly shook the Papal Roman Empire very severely. In fact, the Emperor Charles was commissioned by the then reigning Pope to gather a tremendous army to absolutely wipe out the reformers in Germany, Holland and the Northern Territories, right in Scandinavia. And the Emperor Charles, hoping to win a million years of indulgences probably, went to work and spent his fortune gathering together the greatest army of the day. When they were assembled, he began to march northwards against the Lutherans in Germany, and the size of this army predetermined the total destruction of the Christian. There wasn't any hope of survival. The army was so huge and powerful. And the princes, which gathered together to withstand this great force, had no hope of conquering numbers for numbers. And then at this point of time, tidings reached the papists that a huge army of Turks was coming up through the eastern part of Europe and marching on Vienna. And the gigantic army of Charles was forced then to forget all about the Protestants who were less of a threat than were the Turks. And Charles's army turned southeast to meet the Turks. There was a long, fierce war, and by the time that war was over, Charles's army had lost the capacity to go and fight against the Christians, and so the Church of God was saved, because Satan's forces fought against Satan's forces. Now, as the Word of God says, of course, a kingdom divided against itself cannot stand. So the papists then found that their own purposes of world dominion were destroyed by their own policies. So I read to you in our last study period, the prophet Muhammad came into being and gained strength because first of all he was stood against the papal abuses and were able to find many other folk discontented likewise with the papal abuses. Good, let's leave the seventh, well, not quite yet. We have more in the sixth trumpet yet, but now we come to the more interesting part of the sixth trumpet in Revelation chapter 11, and then the seventh trumpet in the last part of chapter 11. But first of all, the very beautiful and wonderful chapter, Revelation chapter 10. And this will engage our attention now for a study period of two, because this is very, very rich with priceless information. Revelation 10, start with verse 1. Perhaps we'll just read the chapter straight through to get the context clear in mind, and then we can come back and look at each individual verse one by one. And I saw another mighty angel come down from heaven, clothed with a cloud, and a rainbow was upon his head, and his face was as it were the sun, and his feet as pillars of fire. And he had in his hand a little book open, and he set his right hand upon the sea and his left foot upon the earth, and cried with a loud voice as when a lion roareth. And when he had cried, seven thunders uttered their voices. And when the seven thunders had uttered their voices, I was about to write. And I heard a voice from heaven saying unto me, seal up those things which the seven thunders uttered, and write them not. And the angel which I saw stand upon the sea and upon the earth lifted up his hand to heaven, and swear by him that liveth for ever and ever, who created heaven and the things that therein are, and the earth and things that are therein, and the sea, and the things which are therein, that there should be time no longer, or as the margin says, there should be no more delay, but in the days of the voice of the seventh angel, when he shall begin to sound, the mystery of God should be finished, as he hath declared to his servants the prophets. And the voice which I heard from heaven spake unto me again, and said, Go and take the little book which is open in the hand of the angel, which standeth upon the sea upon the earth. And I went unto the angel, and said unto him, Give me the little book. And he said unto me, Take it, and eat it up, and it shall make thy belly bitter, that shall be in thy mouth sweet as honey. And I took the little book out of the angel's hand, and ate it up, and it was in my mouth sweet as honey. And as soon as I had eaten it, my belly was bitter. And he said unto me, Thou must prophesy again before many peoples, and nations, and tongues, and kings. Back now to verse 1. By the way, to give a general oversight of this particular chapter, of course, it is the... We now find that at the very time when these mighty forces are battling each other upon the earth, God has set his hand to build that final movement for which the work will be finished. And glorious opportunity was given to God to do that, because when the enemies of God's people were preoccupied in destroying each other, that is, the Romanists and the Islamic were bent on destroying each other, that kept them so completely occupied that God could now go to work undisturbed to build the great and wonderful second advent movement, which is foretold here in Revelation chapter 10. And obviously enough, of course, the bittersweet experience, or the sweet bitter experience, was the experience of the great disappointment in 1844, when the sweetest expectations were replaced by the most bitter disappointment. Who now is this mighty angel? He is none other than Jesus Christ in person. I turn to the comments in the Bible commentary on Revelation chapter 10, where this fact is confirmed in these words. Page 971, volume 7, Bible commentary. Comment on Daniel 10, verses 1 to 11. The mighty angel who instructed John with no less a person than Jesus Christ, setting his right foot upon the sea and his left upon the dry land, shows the part which he is acting in the closing scene of the great controversy with Satan. This position denotes his supreme power and authority over the whole earth. The controversy has waxed stronger and more determined from age to age, and will continue to do so to the concluding scenes when the masterly working of the powers of darkness shall reach their height. Satan, united with evil men, will deceive the whole world and the churches who receive not the love of the truth. But the mighty angel demands attention. He cries with a loud voice. He is to show the power and authority of his voice to those who have united with Satan to oppose the truth. And that, of course, leaves no question as to who this mighty angel is. It could have been Gabriel, but it wasn't. It was Jesus Christ himself in person. The statement says he's come down from heaven, a simple practical statement, of course. He hasn't fallen from there, as the star does in Revelation 8, verse 1. He came down, and this coming down of Jesus Christ from the heavens to the earth once again impresses upon our minds the very close relationship that Jesus Christ sustains to his earthbound children. Now, I could name some places today which are very, very degraded, very dirty, very unpleasant, very poverty-stricken. I think, for instance, of Bombay in India. Now, I've never seen such poverty as I saw in that particular city. So much want, so much degradation, so much disease. I was there only for a few hours, and I don't ever care to go back. For instance, I saw, as we drove down one particular road back to the airport, a place where there was a kind of a pavement, a dirt pavement beside the road. There was no actual curbing, as I remember it now. And there were one or two poles which had been cut down from trees somewhere about, poles about 3 to 4 inches thick and about maybe 10 to 12 feet long. And they were leaning up against a fence. I think it was a corrugated iron fence. And the top was about 4 feet from the ground, and of course the other end was on the ground a few feet away. And tossed over this were a few branches, one or two sacks, there's potato sacks, gunny sacks, whatever you call them in this country. And I think one or two here and there may have had a sheet of corrugated iron. And that was, and there were dozens of them, not just one or two, just dozens of these. And crowded into each one of them was a complete family. Now, not two children. 8, 10, 12 children. They must have slept on top of each other, beside each other, beneath each other, across each other, to fit in that tiny space. And that represented all their aristocratic had by way of living, and they went out all day long to beg just a little bit of food, and beggars are despised in India, and I never saw anyone give a beggar anything when I walked around the streets of Bombay. And the poverty there is absolutely appalling. Now, and I saw it as such, of course, in the contrast between the life we live in Australia, or here in America, we have nice clean homes, have cars, and when the rain and the snow come, we have warm rooms to live in, and quite spacious rooms. Now, if I was called upon today to go away from my home in Australia to live in Bombay, in one of those very, very poor areas, and serve there, I wouldn't jump with joy. But now think of Jesus, and if I went there, it would be a very, very visible expression of my love for those people, if I went there voluntarily. Now, Jesus Christ, you think of the comparison now between heaven above, with all its glory and splendor, with all its riches and love and everything that you can think about, and of course we can't conceive the glory of heaven, can we? That's beyond our understanding at the present moment. Someday we'll see it, then we'll know it, but not at the present time. Now, Jesus Christ is prepared to leave that even today, as this chapter plainly points out, and to come down and to play a very personal and intimate role in the final affairs of men. Now, he's coming from heaven to this earth is far greater a transitional comparison than if we left our present places and went to live in Bombay, India. Isn't that so? So this does picture the very intimate relationship that Jesus Christ sustains toward us. He comes down to this earth to participate in this great battle because he loves us and because he longs to see us brought back to him and into perfect harmony and peace again with him. When we read the other day from Thespis to Ministers that when we rightfully understand the book of Revelation, we shall have an entirely different Christian experience. Now, I think that as we talked this morning in our first study period, we began to see how the understanding of this book will bring us an entirely different experience. And we come to appreciate and see the way in which Jesus Christ longs and sacrifices and works to bring us back to him, as we do in the 10th chapter of Revelation. It will also help us to rise to a much higher level of association with him. And it says he was clothed with a cloud. What does a cloud do? Ask a pilot. What does a cloud do? It obscures. Is that right? You can't see where you're going when you're in a cloud. That is, with ordinary visible eyesight. If the instrument panel is full of nice instruments, of course you do know where you're going and where you are and everything else about it. You're so many distance, you're so many miles from a certain beacon and you're flying in a certain direction, and so you know just about where you are if you look at a map. But the point is, a cloud obscures. And when people are in clouds, they don't know where they're going. And so there obviously must have been some obscurity associated with this ministry of Christ when he came down with one foot upon the earth and the other foot upon the sea. Now, thinking back to the experience of the folk in the great Second Advent movement, was there in fact such an obscurity? There certainly was. And what was this obscurity? What couldn't they see correctly? The sanctuary. They thought that this earth was the sanctuary, and thinking that, they naturally concluded, of course, that the cleansing of the sanctuary was the cleansing of this earth, and therefore the second coming of Jesus Christ at the end of the 2,300 days or years. So Christ came down clothed with a cloud. Now, for the moment, I want to pass by the expression of rainbows upon his head. I want to talk about the seven thunders for a brief moment, because there's a very close connection between these seven thunders and this cloud, verse 3 and 4. And cried with a loud voice, as when a lion roareth, and when he had cried, seven thunders uttered their voices. And when the seven thunders had uttered their voices, I was about to write, and I heard a voice from heaven saying unto me, seal up those things which the seven thunders uttered, and write them not. Have you ever felt disappointed when you've read those words? A little cheated, perhaps? A little deprived? Likewise, I've felt the same way back in Hebrews, the 6th chapter, where Paul says that there are many things he'd like to tell us about Melchizedek, but he couldn't tell them because of the dullness of their hearing and the stoneness of their heart. And I'm convinced that there are things which ought to have been written but were never written about Melchizedek that we don't have today, don't have access to at the present time. However, in regard to the seven thunders, we don't have to be too disappointed, because we do know what those seven thunders contain. I'll read you that now in the Bible Commentary, volume 7, page 971, right on from where I left off just a few moments ago. After these seven thunders uttered their voices, the injunction comes to John as to Daniel in regard to the little book, seal up those things which the seven thunders uttered. These relate to future events which will be disclosed in their order. So we shall be deprived, they will be disclosed. Daniel shall stand in his lot at the end of the days. John sees the little book unsealed. Then Daniel's prophecies have their proper place in the first, second and third angels' messages to be given to the world. The unsealing of the little book was the message in relation to time. The books of Daniel and the revelation are one. One is a prophecy, the other a revelation. One a book sealed, the other a book opened. John heard the mystery which the thunders uttered, but he was commanded not to write them. The special light given to John, which was expressed in the seven thunders, was a delineation of events which would transpire under the first and second angels' messages. It was not best for the people to know these things, for their faith must necessarily be tested. In the order of God, most wonderful and advanced truths would be proclaimed. The first and second angels' messages were to be proclaimed, but no further light was to be revealed before these messages had done their specific work. This is represented by the angel standing with one foot on the sea, proclaiming with a most solemn oath that time should be no longer. So then, put these things together now. Jesus Christ came down clothed with a cloud. The seven thunders uttered their voices, and in uttering their voices revealed the events to transpire under the proclamation of the first and the second angel's messages, which meant, of course, that the seven thunders provided information which would have taken away that cloud, right? Wouldn't they? To take away that cloud. And because of this, the Lord prohibited that clarification to be given until certain tests had been experienced by the people of God. Now this, of course, raises a very, very serious question in regard to God's character. Now, I'm not suggesting, of course, that God's character is under question. It's not really, but it does raise a question we need to understand. There's no question about God's character being just and fair, and God does nothing arbitrarily to bring about a time of trouble unnecessarily, but at the same time, there's some principle involved here, because in the book I'll be writing, Sister White says that God's hand was placed over certain facts in the prophecy until it was withdrawn after 1844. Remember the statement? I'm not quite sure where it is at the moment either. Anyone remember where it is? Let's see if I can find it here very quickly perhaps. But Sister White plainly tells us that the hand was kept over various aspects of the message until certain tests had been experienced by the people of God, and then the Lord allowed this to be withdrawn. And that always, to me, seemed to indicate an action on God's part which made him an arbitrary decider as to what the people of God should pass through and what they should not pass through. And it seemed very wrong on the surface that God would do something that would bring to the people pain and suffering that they didn't need to suffer, although I suppose they really did need to suffer the pain and suffering which they did. I didn't think about this before the study opened, and so I didn't have time to look for it then, but I'll look for it, I think, during the end of, I'll read it again tonight. Very good. Now, how shall we understand then this action on God's part to keep back the light from the people of God until they have passed through a series of tests, and were then, as God was concerned, was fit to understand and receive this light? How should we explain this? Pardon? Yes, but we're talking about principles now which are involved in this sort of thing. And while God knows what is best, of course, he is bound by certain principles of operation. He never goes outside of those principles of operation. In other words, I think in terms of natural law or cause and effect being involved in this sort of situation. I just don't see it quickly now in the book of the writings, which is where I know it to be. Right, now let's see if you follow the argument very carefully now that I'm talking about in this situation. And the argument is that somewhere says in the Spirit of Prophecy that God held his hand over certain elements of truth which caused them to lack a complete understanding of the second angel, of the first and second angel's messages, which in turn caused them to suffer that fearful disappointment which broke the faith of so many of the people. And I would say, of course, that those whose faith was broken were foolish virgins anyway, and certainly purified the church and brought it out into the third angel's message with only wise virgins, at least for the beginning. Now I'm wondering if there is of course the fact that God knows what is for our best good, and the real reason as to why people did not grasp the light on this particular point was that for so long their minds had been bound by human traditions, human ideas, human theories, as were the apostles in Christ's day, that they were quite incapable of seeing that thing. Now God, of course, has made the human mind in such a way that it can be made immune to erroneous doctrines. We can become so established upon the truth by years and years of repetition, years and years of study, that we come to that place where we're absolutely confirmed in the truth. Now that same force or law which works for our good, and that of course is the hand of God which produces that kind of stability, that kind of solidity, that very, very same law can work very much against us. Because if error is placed in our minds year after year after year, systematically inculcated, forced upon us by the power of the will, then what do we finally become so far as error is concerned? Sealed or fixed in that error. Now the Roman Catholic Church, for instance, says, give us a child until he is seven, and what about it? He is ours for life. He is ours for life. Remember when I was a colporteur in North Queensland many, many years ago now, and I must say that colporteuring was the worst experience of my entire life. There's nothing I like less than that job. It was a terrible job. But you know, I came one day to it was a very, very strong Roman Catholic district, and I came to this door, and a woman came out. I began to canvass her with the book, I think, Desire of Ages of Bible Readings. I've forgotten which it was now. And then came the girl, the daughter must have heard what was going on. She came out, only 10 years of age, or maybe 11, maybe 12 at the outside. And they were people with an Italian or Greek background that was evident because of their features and colouring. And it was an area in North Queensland where lots and lots of Italian people actually lived. And that daughter paused only for a few seconds to evaluate the book I was canvassing, and then she really turned upon her mother, who was showing some interest, and told her that she must not, under any circumstances, even look at this book. Send this man away. The priest has told us we're not to look at this material, and that girl reflected a very, very powerful in her behalf.
Well, if you can, if not, make what's not gotten in the fight, false, you need to know, and you have to do the same.